Onboarding is crucial for both companies and employees as it sets the tone for the beginning of a productive and fulfilling professional relationship. However, according to Devlin Peck, only 69% of companies have a formal onboarding process for employees across the company, and 53% have an onboarding program of less than 7 days. These programs not only don't last long enough to have meaningful impact, they aren't well designed either. Welcome to episode 193 of This Shit Works, a podcast dedicated to all things networking, relationship building, and business development. I'm your host, Julie Brown, speaker, author, and networking coach. And today I am joined by Jake Stahl, a fractional chief learning officer who over the past 30 years has created world-class onboarding programs in 6 countries and has spoken about it in 47 states.
Welcome to This Shit Works, your weekly no-nonsense guide to networking your way to more friends, more adventures, and way more success with your host, Julie Brown. Here we go.
According to Jake, to hire an employee, on average, costs the company $18,000 just to have them walk through the door. Then they have hardware and software costs, benefits, and their first pay. All in all, a company invests well over $50,000 before the person even sits at their desk for the first time. Did you know that the number one reason that an employee leaves a company in their first 6 months of employment is because of onboarding? Or shitty onboarding, or no onboarding at all. And that number is just increasing, by the way. So, how can companies design onboarding programs that work, that allow new hires to integrate seamlessly into their roles, contribute meaningfully to projects, and adapt to the company's processes and workflows efficiently, and build important inter-office relationships? Well, we're going to get into all of that and so much more with our guest today. So without further ado, Jake, it's so wonderful to have you here today.
Good morning, and thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here.
So, onboarding. It's clear that effective onboarding is pivotal for not just employers, but the employees as well. Could you elaborate a little on why onboarding holds such power within an organization, and then why so many companies are failing at onboarding experiences?
Yeah. So if we think about when we're doing the hiring process, it's an everybody puts their best foot forward process. So the company shows its best faces, it does its best interview, it provides its benefit package and the salary, all in an effort to bring a new employee on board. A new employee reciprocates by putting all their stuff on a resume and following up on the interviews and weighing their options. You know, is the pay low, but the benefits good? So everybody does this same process of decision-making when it comes to bringing somebody on board. However, once that courting relationship is over, then the honeymoon phase starts. And if you think about this in the way of a marriage, you think about if you get married and the wedding goes off without a hitch and you're great, and then you go on your honeymoon and it's day after day of stormy weather. The two of you get into an argument because the room's not as big as you thought it would be. It tends to put a taint on the whole process, and it tends to set the precedent for whether you're going to be happy in days to come. So if we think about first impressions being everything, the onboarding is the first impression of how a company is going to take care of you. And if they don't take care of you in the first couple of days, it's really tough to get that feeling back again. And then to the point you discussed already, in the first 6 months, people tend to leave if they're not happy. But that first couple of days sets the stage for all of it.
When it comes to onboarding, what do you think is the ideal length of time? What is the most effective length of time for onboarding?
Well, it depends on what your objectives are. Keep in mind that onboarding can take a lot of different shapes and sizes. So let's say you're bringing on a person in the legal department. That onboarding may be just getting them used to the department, the current things that the company is looking at in the way of cases or legal procedures that need to be done. In that case, it may be as simple as a week. But if you bring on somebody in customer service or somebody in sales, you've got a bigger nut to crack, right? Because they need to know what happens with a customer before it gets to them. What are they supposed to do? What happens after the customer leaves them? And they need to have full product knowledge on everything in the company. And that's to say nothing of integration into the culture, right?
Right.
If I'm not integrated in the culture and feel good about who I'm working with, it can be terrible. So even the onboardings, I develop a mentor program to cover people through the first 6 months of their training that they can work with a manager or a colleague. And just to get off on a slight tangent, the funny thing about a mentor program is new employees hate to go to their bosses with questions because they don't want to make the boss think I did a bad hire. So they prefer going to another colleague. So I always institute a mentor program to get them comfortable and let them know any questions they have, they can ask at any time. But heading back to your question, customer service and sales, I've already done 4-week onboardings with them, depending on what the product portfolio looks like, the procedures the company has, and what their end goals are for the training.
So you mentioned culture, and often companies talk about culture, but I think it's an often overlooked part of an onboarding process. Like, how are we going to integrate this person into our culture, help them build relationships? You know, the studies are staggering about 68% of people feel like they don't have social connections at work, which trickles down into 40% of people feeling that they don't trust their coworkers. And it's because we're not building relationships.
Right.
And, you know, only, I believe the statistic is off the top of my head, if I'm remembering correctly, that only 25% of onboarding programs create, you know, a part of the program being relationship building, cross-silo networking, only 25% even have that as an objective of onboarding. So when you are creating onboarding experiences for companies, what are the tips? What are the tools you create for them, the processes and frameworks you create with them so that you are creating engagement between seasoned employees and new employees from day one?
Right. So when I go into companies, what I often find is they've committed what I call random acts of training. And what that means is some people have certain skill levels and some people don't, and some people know about their whole portfolio and some don't. So one of the first things I do is get a level set with the company and see who knows what, because you don't want to assign them to a mentor that is largely unaware of what's going on. So part of it is getting a level set and then making sure the employees coming in have that level set. But you hit on something earlier. I would be willing to guarantee less than 1% of onboarding programs cover, and that's generational differences in learning. So if you have a Gen Xer that comes into a millennial environment, the millennial environment is going to be encompassed by learning management systems, videos, and go on YouTube and do this and that. But if you have a Gen Xer or even a baby boomer, which is still a significant part of the workforce, you have them come in, you're automatically shutting them out of the culture because they may not be as savvy. They may not enjoy it, you know, assimilating information from a video. So part of onboarding should be a generational look as to how they prefer to learn when they come in. And then how do you assimilate a baby boomer into a millennial environment or vice versa? You know, all those things need to be taken into consideration when you're doing an onboarding program, and yet they're largely overlooked.
And what do you do? I'm very interested in, like you, I work with large companies and I try to create relationship maps across silos. And I'm quite interested in how we can build frameworks, especially starting from onboarding, where we create cross-silo relationships that actually will grow and will blossom. They're not just a one-off, like you meet with this person and then you never see them again. Like, what do you think are the most effective things within onboarding? Because people are so in onboarding, they're so into like, I got to learn the rules for my job and the moving parts of my job, to the detriment of not being blind to what all the other moving parts of the company are.
Right. Yes. And that's an excellent question. And I have my own term for this, so I'm just going to throw out maybe new slang for you. I always make sure we have what's called the parade of kings. And what that means is, and that's actually, I guess, a little sexist. So let's say parade of kings and queens. And
kings and queens.
So you have introductions to all of the heads of the departments. So part of the onboarding is, let's say the head of HR comes in. Hey, I'm Jake, head of HR. This is what my department does. This is who your contacts will be. This is when you'll need us. This is when you won't. And when you can get a chance as a new hire to talk to a department head and feel welcome, it is an amazing experience. And then I actually have the directors that they'll be dealing with, the people who they'll be working with side by side. I have them come onto the onboarding too and have them describe, when does the customer hit their department? When does the customer leave their department? Because one of the most important things, or the most important pieces of onboarding, is somebody knowing how much their job function affects the bottom line of the customer.
Right.
When you know how much of an effect you have, you feel better. So I make sure they're introduced to everybody they will be talking to as part of the process of them dealing with customers. And I think it can't be missed. It is such a huge part of the process.
When you were saying, when you're meeting with department heads and the department heads are saying, this is, you know, this is when you will need us, this is when you won't, like, part of me thinks that that is very informative and we need information to, you know, make decisions and know where we stand and whatnot. But like, I know one of your strengths is in conversation,
right?
And the ability to have really good conversations. And so I want to turn a little bit to the relationships and conversations that happen within companies, because I know this is your strong suit. Like, from the moment we walk through the door to the, well, however long our tenure is, we will have interactions with people. And if we can make those interactions more meaningful through conversation, through have effective conversation, I think that's really important. So you have this thing called the Adaptive Conversational Blueprint. And I do not know what that is. So I would love it if you would tell us a little bit about that and how that works within organizations.
Absolutely. So my degree is in psychology, and I have multiple certifications in neurolinguistic programming. And what all of those things teach you is that if you can make yourself like another person, in other words, similar in the way they talk, in the way they act, your bond will grow and your communication will be better. So neurolinguistic programming says basically you have five modalities, but three which are used primarily, which is visual, auditory, and kinesthetic. So by talking to another person, I can start to understand the way they process information. And as I mirror them, their body gestures, their motions, when I move to their cadence of speech, we start to form a bond. But here's the amazing thing, and this has been proven time and time again. You and I could have a great conversation, and you could feel good after that conversation. But that feel good doesn't come from the conversation. It comes from talking to me, and you associate that good feeling with me. And what that does is that sets a precedent for all conversations to come. And the foundation of this is really just the listening aspect. How much time do I give you to talk about who you are and what you do? And an amazing thing happens when you do that. The more I listen to you and ask you about you and understand what you do, you get kind of a reciprocation switch that clicks in your head. And after a while, you come back to me and say, my God, Jake, I've done nothing but talk about me. So tell me about you. And at that time, you are the most receptive to whatever messaging I can give. And because I made you feel good about me, you're going to want to talk to me again. So the Adaptive Conversational Blueprint says, break the conditioning of talking while you're thinking about what you're going to say next, or listening while thinking about what you're going to say next.
Yep.
And I teach you how to break that conditioning. And then I teach you basics of neurolinguistic programming so you can adapt your conversation on the fly to make sure you're getting the most out of the entire conversation. It's fantastic. I've done this with numerous companies and the results are incredible. And all we're really doing is teaching you how to talk and listen again.
I suck at listening without my own voice in my head, figuring out how I'm going to respond. And I don't think it's because I'm a narcissist and I just want to talk or like I want to dominate the conversation. I think it's because of who I am and what I do. I get so excited to talk to people that I let it run in my brain too fast. And I have a tendency of cutting people off because I'm like, oh, I just want to I have to tell you, me too. And so what do you do for someone like me who is, I'm not doing it because I don't want to learn about that person. I'm just doing it because I get so excited talking to other people.
Part of it is focusing on what the other person is saying. And what I typically have people do is have them do what I call the 2-10 rule. So the 2-10 rule says that for every 10 minutes you talk, you generate about 2 minutes of questions in the other person. This has been shown time and time again. Public speakers, if you're talking for 10 minutes, I guarantee you created 2 minutes worth of questions. And what winds up happening is people get excited about the question. So I just want to interrupt. I just want to say this. I need to get the question out of the way. So as a speaker, you establish a cadence for yourself. You give yourself 2 minutes before you jump in. And during that 2 minutes, you really focus on what they're saying to the point where you repeat some of the things back that they said. So if my wife and I are having a conversation at the end of the day, and she talks a lot of banking terms. So she'll say, you know, Jake, we were dealing with ACHs today. And she goes to move on and I'll say, ACH? And then it forces her to stop and slow down. It makes me have some time to think about what she's saying and maybe even think about what I'm going to say next. But the 2-10 rule basically wraps police tape around time parameters in your conversation. And to help people with this, I've actually had people buy stopwatches. And after a while, what happens is you get so used to this, you create a new habit. And what's amazing is your conversations flourish. Not only that, but when you show genuine interest in somebody else to the point where you don't cut them off, allow them to finish a thought, your relationship evolves.
Yeah, I always feel like I think what mine comes from is I'm always afraid I'm going to not remember what I wanted to ask them about the story. So instead of letting them continue the story and then asking my questions, I'm afraid I'm not going to remember what I was going to ask them or what I was going to say or some pithy thing I was going to say to them, you know? Yeah. It's definitely something I need to work on for sure. And I think it's a byproduct of being a professional speaker where literally I just talk for an hour and people listen.
Right. Yep. And what's amazing is if you use this 2-10 rule during I've done public speaking all over and invited to speak internationally. And one thing I've noticed is if you use a 2-10 rule during speaking, it's amazing. And what the 2-10 rule in speaking is for every 2 minutes that you talk, you invite an interaction with a group. Like, does this make sense? Hey, is everybody with me? So you do that every 10 minutes, 2 minutes. And then at the end of 10 minutes, you kind of go, listen, I've been blathering for a while. We covered a lot of topics. Any questions have come up in the audience? So you open it up again. So what you find happens is, since people are constantly generating questions in their head, you give the audience a chance to empty their head out to focus on what you're going to say next. The last public speaker I taught this to, he was amazed at the difference in his presentations and the audience involvement.
So within conversations, I have heard you say that there is a power of using the word could versus the word should. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. And there's a lot of power words like that. And could and should are super powerful. So think about the last time you made a decision and that decision did not pan out. And you're thinking, oh God, I should have done that. A very good friend of mine used to tell me, you can't, shouldn't have anything. Or you can't, should have any, because it's just not possible. So reframing these thoughts, like what should I do to reach this revenue this year? Mm-hmm. Change that to could. And what winds up happening is you start to brainstorm about things that you can do to make that happen. Walt Disney had a famous saying, and it was, I look at what everybody else does, and then I do the exact opposite. So he never said, I should do what they're doing. He said, what can I do, even if it's not what everybody else is doing? And when you start reprogramming your brain to say, that lousy decision, that bad refrigerator I bought, oh, I should have shopped more. Well, could you have shopped more? Are you cash-strapped? Were you time-strapped? When you start thinking about what you can do versus what you should do, it creates an entire change in mindset. But changing the could for should takes some effort. For those of us who always say, I should have done this, it's very difficult to change into that. Well, let me substitute in the word could.
Yeah. So the listeners know that I'm a Peloton addict. I love the tread, the bike, the mat workouts, the yoga workouts. And Jess Sims is one of the instructors I really enjoy. And she always reminds us at the beginning of every workout, like, you don't have to do this. You get to do this.
Right. Yep.
And there are so many people, whether they are sick or, you know, for whatever reason, can't move the way your body moves.
Right.
So you don't have to do it. You get to do it. And I think that's also, that is change. I love working out, but there are days where I'm like, I can't believe I have to do this morning. No, I don't have to. I get to.
Right. And that is a great difference in mindset. Another great difference in mindset is changing nouns to verbs. So a good example is if somebody says, I love dogs. You get the idea that they do love dogs, but it could be a temporary mindset. That's much different than saying, I'm a dog lover. That implies past, present, and future. So when you say you like to ride Peloton, instead of saying, you know, I like to ride the bike, I'm a biker. Like to run, I'm a runner. It starts changing your mindset to say, this is going to happen well into the future, as well as happening into the present. So all these different little word changes, you know, there was a great book, What Do We Say When We Talk to Ourselves? That's a lot of the key things, changing key words.
Yeah, I think, and I can't remember, it might have been the book Atomic Habits, where it said, if you start calling yourself something, you'll become it. Like if you want to be a runner, you don't say, oh, I want to be a runner. You say, no, I'm a runner. Even if you run 10 feet, you're running. Guess what? You're a runner.
Exactly.
So there is power in that. It's just a constant reminder in your brain to do it. And I feel like my prefrontal cortex is already like overloaded with all of the decisions I have to make every single day. And reminding myself of these changes, I feel like, is hard for my frontal cortex. Is like, aren't we doing all right? All right, are we doing well? You know?
Well, making changes one at a time is definitely helpful as well. There's no question that the dieting market is a tough market because they ask you to make wholesale changes you wouldn't normally change. So the self-talk market is the same way. Change one piece of self-talk for a month until it becomes a habit. Then add another in. And it's more manageable. Because as humans, we like to think we have this unlimited amount of brain power. And honestly, we don't. It needs to be chunked out and delivered in little pieces so we can assimilate it.
Yeah. Like I feel like at any given moment in my day, I'm facing decision fatigue. And that is also creating structures around you where you don't have to make so many decisions. Like plan out what you're going to wear the night before and put out your running clothes the night before. Like you're have decisions already made for you so that you're not taxing your decision-making abilities so much throughout the day.
Yeah, and I just wrote a newsletter article on this very thing. I read that a scientist agreed that we make close to 30,000 decisions in any given day. So decision fatigue is very real.
I call it, like, in my brain, like the Baskin Robbins. It's like if you went to an ice cream store and there was chocolate and vanilla, you wouldn't sit in there and hang off for 40 minutes. But you go to like an ice cream stand, there's 47. You have no idea what you want because you don't want to make the wrong idea. It's like it's fucking ice cream. Just get an ice cream. If you don't like it, get another one.
Yeah. My wife and I just took my mother-in-law to a diner just this past week, and it had 8 pages packed with food choices. It's like, this is stressful picking out a food choice.
Yeah.
You know, like, give me 5 items on a menu and let me go from there.
I know. I'm like, literally prefrontal cortexes are like, give me a break. I mean, I don't know. We probably weren't designed evolutionary to make this many fast twitch decisions all day long.
Yeah. What were our choices back then? Again, this is what could we have done versus what should we have done? Well, right. I have to go to the bathroom. I know I have to fill my stomach and I need to be warm.
Yeah.
So how am I going to do those three things? And we have more to worry about nowadays.
Yeah. And it was like the 30,000 decisions a day. It's just, and I can't remember the research around it, but how many marketing messages our brain sees every day. Like our brains are doing a lot, even if you think they're not doing anything.
Yeah.
They're doing a lot. I've tried for years to be a meditator and I'm not.
You and me both.
I'm failing.
I'm failing.
Much. Yeah. Like a power of suggestion, I am a meditator is not working for me, Jake. But this woman, Anne Swanson, just sent me this book, Meditation for the Real World. And it's about, and I just started it, and it's literally about just finding moments of silence within your day. Like, even if you're standing, even if you're outside, like, just close, like, even if you just close your eyes for 10 seconds, like, shutting out all of the decisions and all of the messages and everything just for a little bit, like even if in very minute pieces. So I'm trying that out because I am never going to be a sit down and meditate for 30 minutes a day kind of person. It's just not me.
There's a great course that is given in neurolinguistic programming that teaches you how to get out of that rush mindset and get into a more relaxed state. And there's some very basic exercises you can do to do that. And it's hysterical. Even though I'm a master practitioner of it, I still don't take the time that I should. You just get overwhelmed with everything under the sun.
Yeah, I think there's, for me, I've always been a hustler. Just the way I grew up, wanting to get out of certain circumstances and make my own life for myself. And I think there's a part of me in my evolution where I feel like if I slow down, the world will pass me by. Like, I will miss something. I won't be hustling. That is a mindset shift I have to work on. I'm almost 50 years old. I do not have my shit together. That is a mindset shift I still have to work on.
My daughter is very much into the water, and she's a master diver. And she's like, Dad, you have the shark mentality. You have to keep swimming just to breathe and live. And that's the way it goes. So we're a lot alike in that respect. If I'm not constantly moving.
Yeah. We're sharks, dude. We stop moving. We just keel over and die.
Exactly. Yeah.
You have your mind map so that our systems will continue to work even at rest.
Yeah.
Oh, so we could have talked about a lot of shit.
I know. We really could have. We could have. Could have spent a couple of hours.
Yeah? It's too bad. Our time is up. We'll have to have a repeat. We'll talk about
it.
We'll
have a sequel.
Yeah. If you want to learn more about Jake and the work he does with the companies that he works with and how he could work with your company, visit jakestahlconsulting.com. I will put a link to that in the show notes. And thanks for being here today. I really loved our conversation.
You're welcome. And people can also find me on LinkedIn if they choose to. So please feel free to hit me there. But yeah, this was a true pleasure. Thanks very much for this broad spans of topics. This was wonderful.
Right? We were everywhere.
We were.
So thanks so
You're
much.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I say it after probably every interview, but there really was some great stuff in this conversation. I think the thing that was most impactful for me, simply because of how easy it is to begin to put into practice, was the idea of changing out nouns for verbs. I absolutely love this. It begins that small, repetitive activity or pattern in your brain, that mindset shift that will help propel you to bigger actions in the long run. Also, the should versus could conversation and the lesson within that, I think that will be something that will be helpful as I go forward as well. And I'm excited to start shifting out could for should. Okay, on to the drink of the week. I'm still in my sober fitness challenge and we're on day 18. Today is day 18 of that. So we have another mocktail for you. It's the virgin pina colada. And if you don't want it, you know, without alcohol, just toss some rum into it. This recipe makes 4 servings. And here's what you're going to need. 2 cups of pineapple juice, 3/4 cups of cream of coconut. Very important. Cream of coconut, not coconut milk. 4 cups of ice, And then for garnishes, pineapple wedges and maraschino cherries. What you're going to do is you're going to pour the pineapple juice and the cream of coconut into a very high-powered blender, add the ice, and then blend for like 30 to 60 seconds. I put it in my, I have a like a Ninja blender. That's what I do this in because it really can chop up the ice. So blend it until smooth, pour it into some fancy glasses, and then garnish with pineapple and cherries. All right, friends, that's all for this week. If you like what you heard today, please leave a review and subscribe to the podcast. Also, please remember to share the podcast to help it reach a larger audience. If you want more Julie Brown, that's me. You can find my book, This Shit Works, on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. You can find me on LinkedIn at Julie Brown BD. Just send me a note and let me know where you found me when you reach out. I am JulieBrown_BD on the Instagram. Or you can pop on over to my website, JulieBrownBD.com. Until next week, cheers.
Hey, thanks for taking the time to listen. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss a tip. And remember, you can unapologetically be who you authentically are and still be wildly successful. That's a fact. See you next week on This Shit Works.